This isn't just a game, it's a once-in-a-generation event. The Harlem Globetrotters 100-year tour. Celebrate 100 years of high-flying dunks, 100 years of show-stopping moves, and 100 years of changing the game. Bring the whole family and be part of the legacy. This game is once in a century. Be there at Schottenstein Center on December 27th. Go to harlemglobetrotters.com for your tickets to the 100-year tour.
Greetings, travelers.
Greetings, travelers. I paused this time so you could go first because I was jumping
in. Is that my holiday present? I got to go first.
So. Just this once, Mark. Just this once.
I feel so honored. That's amazing.
you should. I have a weird glow, just so everybody knows. That's a dot on my camera.
Yeah, you see it when you do these videos. It's not an orb.
It's not an orb. I could probably do this and make this really bad. Yeah. See, orb gone.
It's amazing.
Yeah, I got rid of the ghost. No. So I'm not even going to talk about what my lighting's doing right now because
it's a thing. Oh my gosh. So for those of you listening in, just know it's a thing.
It's a thing. And we'll be posting these videos starting in January. So you will get to see all of them. I will say this. I have discovered, I know we need to jump right in because we've got a lot of things to talk about in my remaining 12 days of Christmas, or 12 holiday days, I should say, because I discovered a new Wayback Machine thing, which is Blackberry Dr. Pepper.
Oh, that's a classic. Yeah.
Oh, so delightfully yummy. I didn't know about it. I now know about it. I am obsessed. So, that's where I live now.
Many of the flavored Dr. Peppers were hit or miss, but when they hit hard.
Oh, it's so good. So good. Anyway, okay. On to bigger, better. So we did through six, right?
Yeah, we did the first 6 days. We made it through the first half. So I'm
really hoping, still no dolls, that we are into our seventh day of cursed objects. So what is day seven, Mark?
We started with the doll, with the Elsa doll. So I'm starting the second half with the doll. So,
of course you are.
Because it's toys. It's Christmas. Now, I think you're going to love the name of this one.
Okay.
First, it was found in one of my favorite names of a town ever, Wagga Wagga, New South Wales in Australia.
So, we need to move there immediately. That sounds like a place we need to be from.
Yeah, it's one of the best names ever, Wagga Wagga. It's like Bugs Bunny, Walla Walla, Washington. You know, it's Wagga Wagga, New South Wales. Now, this was found in 1972, so back in the Wayback Machine, the 70s.
Good thing I have my new Dr. Pepper with me for this voyage.
Yep. Okay, so two brothers are stepping into this old abandoned house on the day after their grandmother's funeral. So they're in this old abandoned house, and the floorboards are creaking. There's, you know, it's just mist and everywhere. They're just shadows all around them. And one of them, a guy named Kerry Walton, notices something beneath the planks. And he starts pulling it free, and he's thinking it's a bundle of rags. But no, he held a 200-year-old doll.
It had
human hair, glass eyes, and this just crazy grin. He just thought it was this weird toy. But soon as he got it home, guess what? Strange stuff starts happening, right?
Mark, what is it with you guys and taking these things home?
Well, listen here. So it gets to the name. Are you ready for the name of this doll?
No, but you're going to tell me anyway.
Her name is Letta. Letta, and it's short for letting me out. It gets home, and the dogs are not happy about it, right? So they are lunging at it. Now, these are peaceful dolls, but they're lunging at it, but refusing to go close, kind of like how a bear bluffs when it's, you know, just trying to chase you away. It's trying to chase it away. Now, the family also noticed, even though the doll was put away, they would see strange scuff marks on the floor in the morning where something had walked across the floor.
Oh, I don't like this. No, all right. I don't like the direction any of this is going.
Okay, so, and then some visitors reported feeling faint or dizzy when they got near it. So immediately the family's like, this is crazy. Get rid of it. What did you do? Why'd you bring this into our house? Of course, right? So psychics he called in said that there was a soul of a boy who drowned and was trapped inside. And the doll had been crafted in his likeness somewhere in Eastern Europe, most likely Romania, the way it looks. And they dated the doll, again, 200 years old. And he received offers, like large sums of money from people who wanted this doll after he was investigating it because word had gotten out. And he just was like, I can't get rid of this. I'm loving it. And then some other psychic said, no, you are bound to it and you are destined to keep it. And so Letta became part of his family. Now, you know, understandably so, the family's worried about this thing. But despite its grin, it doesn't carry malice, according to him. It carries good luck. He said his family was destitute. And, you know, the grandmother had died. It was like the worst period in his life. That weirdness aside, everything changes for his family. He starts getting money. Things start going better. It didn't hurt that the marketing and stuff that's basically happening because of this doll.
Yeah.
So he thinks it's protective. So is it cursed? Is it a blessing? You know, what is it? Well, here's where it is. Carrie still tours with Letta Meowt. And he shares its story with audiences all across Australia. And people line up to see it and to feel that energy. Pose for photographs. And some people are a little upset, but some people are blessed by it.
You know, it's interesting. I think this goes back to intention and thought process. Like,
exactly.
You take on, you know, different objects and stuff, but I don't think you anticipate them being a problem for you. And I'm not saying none of them ever were a problem, but I think in general, like, people would be very freaked out in your house by the whole book thing, right? And then I gave you a couple books for the holidays here that I got from another book collector. I'm using quotation marks, you know, book hero, saving the books, you know, one book at a time. And you, the first thing you said was, good, your ghost is probably going to be really happy with those books, right?
Yeah.
I think that some people would be really freaked out and trying to get it and blah, 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 but you don't care. The books are, it leaves books. Cool.
Books,
you know,
books are good. And you know, this doll, Letta Meowt, come on. She's got some history. She's 200 plus years old and she's been all over Australia and loving the world. And she's, you know, she's not bottled up like some of the others that we could discuss. But
which I feel like you're going to discuss because we are talking about cursed objects. But it sounds really, fascinating. It sounds like you could look up the touring. I'm assuming you're going to put a link in the show notes.
I will. He has a Facebook page and an Instagram page where he posts where he's going to be. So with the dolls.
Perfect. Oh. I love that.
Yep. And just, you know, just again, a wondrous object. I'm excited by it. So I'm if we make it to Australia, that's my. One of my bucket lists is
one of us is going to make it to Australia. The other has to be able to get on a plane. Cause guess what? I'm not taking a boat.
There's boats and I'm not big on boats either. That's the other problem. So
yeah, no,
we got to get site to site teleportation before I go there. So anyway, all right.
We'd like that. Well,
we did the Hope Diamond in part one.
Yeah.
So I have to go into one that this is one that is, again, I'm trying to be a bit more safe for you. Okay. And there's a reason this one's safe for you. And this is the Koh-i-Noor diamond. Are you familiar with this?
Okay. Now I have to look up what that looks like.
Koh-i-Noor. Now this one, we have to go way back in time. Okay. This is called, all right, the Mountain of Light. This was originally called. And that picture you're looking at is not the original stone. And we'll get to that in a minute. So,
okay.
The Kohinoor, basically glory and high history, but man, has this one got a history. So buckle up, gang. We're going to have some fun with this one. So I almost could do a whole episode on this, but we're going to summarize it. So some say it was mined from the Kohler mines of Golconda, which is now part of India. And probably 12th or 13th century it was dug up. But some people say that this was the Simakata gem of Hindu mythology, a jewel of the gods. And it could be, because we don't know its true origins. All we know is that it turned up in this one dynasty's collection. And we only know about that because the armies of Delhi swept all around that area and they described it in their inventory of this one treasury. And so the first Delhi Sultanate and his family had it, and that's the Mughals. And basically, the curse begins here, because every king who claims the diamond wouldn't last long, and another king would rise to take its place, usually through bloodshed. All right, so basically, there was this legend that says he who owns this diamond will own the world, but will also know all its misfortune. Only God or a woman can wear it with impunity.
Interesting. So see? I can wear it and you cannot.
Exactly. That's why I thought you'd like this one. So
I love that.
All right. So we'll give the reason for this, right? Because the curse here. So first, it's Battle of Pampinat, 1526. There's this famous diamond that's listed in the battle's treasure. So we think that's the Kohinoor. And then this one to emperor, same guy who built the Taj Mahal, Shah Deban, he creates this throne called the Peacock Throne. And it's supposed to be the seat of unimaginable opulence. And it's impressive with rubies and emeralds and pearls. And at the center at the top is the Kohinoor in the head of a jeweled peacock. And this
that
was...
That sounds fancy.
Right? This is... You could deal with that. You could have that as your chair for the podcast.
Yeah, I would love that.
Okay. So, again, Mughal dynasty filled with intrigue and violence. The Shah himself was overthrown and imprisoned by his own son. And then his son seizes the throne and the diamond. And then he has nothing but endless war after he takes over. And the empire's gone, basically, at that point. And so the jewel runs around a little bit. Some people say that was the curse. Wow. The Persians come in, 1739. They sweep in. They wipe out the Mughal emperors. And the diamond is given to them. Now, there's rumors here that the diamond had some different effects there, because there was some murders, there was a general massacre, there was all kinds of craziness. But anyway, the Peacock Throne flees, and with the treasure, now listen to this, this is, sounds like something right out of Aladdin, right? The treasure was carried away by 700 elephants, 4,000 camels, and 12,000 horses. To take
How
all the treasure.
How would you even get that many animals together to do something like that?
Yep. So they're taking that back to Persia, but the diamond is missing. So the Persian king makes a couple tricky things to try to figure out who's hiding the diamond. And he proposes this ceremonial exchange as a sign of friendship and peace. And then one of the gifts unwraps and the diamond falls out. And he's like, oh, the Kohinoor. And that's where it gets its name. Mountain of the Sky. So after that, he's murdered. And then like the Afghan Empire.
After that, he was murdered.
he was murdered. The Afghan Empire takes over, and his reign was violent. And again, he launched the invasion of India and a couple other places, and then he gets wiped out. There's succession. The diamond moves about. The diamond goes here. The diamond goes there. There is so much with this curse. And I could, again, like I said, I could do a whole episode of this. But anyway, it falls down and down and down until finally this one king has it in India. And sadly, he's like, he inherits it at 10 years old. And
wow,
what do we do, right? And so it's basically his grandson, because the king died in prison, and then this grandson inherits the throne, and he's like, what do we do? What do I do? And then the British Empire comes in and says, hey, we're taking it. we're taking your country. We're taking your country, and you're going to give us the stone because we're the British East India Company. We want this stuff. And we get it. And we're going to give it to the Queen of England because it's her birthday. And the gem will be nice for her.
Wow.
So anyway, the journey to England, I have to just mention this as just a quick thing, right? The diamond was packed in an iron box guarded by British officers and was shipped aboard the HMS Medea. All right. En route, the ship was struck by cholera. It was hit by cannon fire at the Mauritanus. And then it was battered by a typhoon. When it finally arrives in London, Queen Victoria herself was recovering from a black eye because which had been attacked by a lunatic right as the diamond was sailing into the city.
Of course she was.
Right? So 1851, the Koh I Noor was displayed at the Great Exhibition in London, and it was the centerpiece. And the crowds flocked because they've been promoting this thing. It's worth millions of dollars, and that's back then, 1850s money. And everybody comes in, and it's like, it's kind of dull. It's not really showing anything. And some of the people actually started calling it the Mountain of Darkness instead of the Mountain of Light.
Oh, wow.
But Prince Albert's like, you can't have that for my queen. So he orders the diamond to be recut. And it's recut. And it's basically reduced from 186 carats down to 105.6 carats. But they're cutting out all the perfections and basically increasing its brilliance. I'm sad we lost nearly half the diamond. But
Well, that's the second story where that's happened.
Yep, exactly. That's what happens with these things. So Queen Victoria wears the Koh I Noor as a brooch. But supposedly the curse was kind of following her, because every time she'd loan it to a different family member, something bad would happen to them. So she was the one who decreed that only female members of the royal family get the stone. And that stayed that way since.
The diamond makes sense. It's in the crowns that are created for the queens.
Yep. Queen Alexandria crown. Then it was moved to the Queen Mary crown. And then finally Queen Elizabeth's crown.
Now it's in Queen Camilla's crown.
Yeah, Camilla's crown. She wore it at her coronation. At the coronation, and again, kind of caused some controversy because India wants it back. They're like, hey, if a Jewish masterpiece got stolen in World War II. By the Nazis, it was returned as best we could to the Jewish history. Well, we'd kind of like it back.
It's a 100-carat diamond. I doubt they're going to get it back.
They ain't giving it back. It's a trophy and it's behind broken glass. It's still in the crown of the Queen Mother, and you can go see it if you ever want to see it. But its story is crazy. I mean, like just some of the pieces. One of my favorites is Nader Shah. He killed tens of thousands in Delhi, and so he was massacred by his own guards. That was just a few weeks after getting the diamond. it's just nuts.
Go ahead.
You know, as I said, the British East India Company almost destroyed by the Indian Rebellion in 1857. just 2 years after getting the stone and giving it to Queen Elizabeth.
Well, you know, what's always interesting is that people with absolute wealth in general seem to become corrupt. Like, I think there is an inherent situation that occurs. I can list many examples of this where very few people are very philanthropic with their wealth. And so, I'm not surprised. I kind of wonder if that's like a little bit of a parallel situation that goes on there.
Yep.
It's weird. Okay, so that's eight. Where are we going with number nine?
Number nine, we're going to Iowa.
Okay, well, that's very different than the UK, so no more fish and chips for me. Let's go to
Australia. We're going to Iowa. And this one, I wanted to give you this one as a present, but this is one that sits there, and it is a super Christmas legend. All right?
Okay.
This is a statue, and it's in Council Bluffs, Iowa, so we can go visit Field of Dreams not too far from there. And so that's kind of fun. And for those who remember that movie and book series. So
if you anyway, make it, they will come. Or if you build it, they will come.
If you build it, they will he will come. He will come. Basically, anyone who says if they do certain things at this statue, something happens. But let's go through this, all right?
Mm-hmm.
So coming off the Missouri River.
What is it a statue of?
Well, it's in Fairview Cemetery, and it is a bronze angel. And it is now called the Black Angel of Council Bluffs because it has been darkened. And it's basically its hand is outstretched, kind of offering a bowl. And her formal name is the Ruth Ann Dodge Memorial and was created by Daniel Chester French in 1918. And about a century of ghost stories here. So on the night, you see the picture?
Yeah, I see a picture of it. It's creepy.
Yep. So anyway, Ruth Ann Dodge is said to have described a dream where she was on a lonely shore and this angel offered her a bowl. Her husband, General Greenville M. Dodge, commissioned this guy, Daniel Cheater French, to capture that vision. And the result was placed up there overlooking the city. Now, the memorial never had a formal dedication, but that's where people kind of, that's where this gap comes. Where did it appear? Why did it suddenly appear and all that? But the curse stories begin almost immediately, and this has become a great place to legend trip. Teenagers dare each other to go touch the angel's outstretched hand, and when they touch it, they say it feels ice cold. Even in summer, no matter how hot it is outside, the hand feels ice cold. And again, told by campfires, the tales are anybody who touches it suffers an accident or a sudden illness or something terrible. But others say that the angel's eyes follow you, and if they follow you and then you touch the hand, particularly if you touch it in moonlight, it will grant you a blessing instead of the curse. And that's why so many kids dare each other to try it. And all that, we have car crashes, unexpected deaths in a family, local businesses fail, vandalism incidents near the monument, and everything just folds right into that curse narrative. And there's actually, the local historians there have cataloged the artistry and the rumors. So it's pretty good.
Oh, wow.
So they've noticed many are unsubstantiated, but some definitely, you know, make it valuable. And so they were telling me that they acknowledge how a powerful, striking image can be in a small city's imagination. I love that line. And it is on the National Register of Historic Places. And it is considered Council Bluffs' most valuable artistic treasure, even though it is their most famous ghost story. And so go there at dusk, and the bluff kind of drops away behind her, and you got a masterpiece of architecture and beauty in front of you. And, you know, go touch your hand. See if it gives you a blessing.
So. Well, how about see if the eyes follow you? And if you feel like the eyes are following you, touch your hand. If they don't appear to be following you or you don't get a good vibe, don't touch the hand. Mark, you are way too truth or dare on the situation. And you would dare people to touch the hand all the time. It is terrible. And please be safe. But we will include the link in the show notes if you want to take your chances with this beauty. It's beautiful. The statue is absolutely magnificent.
Amazing, beautiful statue. So, all right. Well, with that, I think we need a break for the next few.
So, yes. Because we got three more to go, right?
Three more to go. I may throw in a bonus.
I can't wait. Bonus presents usually are good things, but in this case, I don't feel like they're going to be. So we'll be back after a word from our delightful sponsors.
Destiny Beard, the lyrical soprano who will haunt your dreams. With her alluring melodies and intricate harmonies, this dark siren of wistful song shall capture your soul and lead you into the night. Check out Destiny's new single, The Haunting Is Over, with international musicians Sam Haynes and Gary Bennett, as well as her other musical works at destinybeard.com.
This isn't just a game, it's a once-in-a-generation event. The Harlem Globetrotters 100-year tour. Celebrate 100 years of high-flying dunks, 100 years of show-stopping moves, and 100 years of changing the game. Bring the whole family and be part of the legacy. This game is once in a century. Be there at Schottenstein Center on December 27th. Go to HarlemGlobetrotters.com for your tickets to the 100-year tour.
That's my Christmas present, listening to Destiny's music every time.
Oh, it's so amazing. She's so fantastic.
Just keeps on giving. I was so glad we were able to put in My Shadow and Me there for that episode we did with the Hat Man, that listeners. Yes. So, all right. Well, next one you're going to love. It's one of your favorite places in the world. Louisiana.
I love Louisiana. Where are we going in Louisiana?
Well, we're going to a place that made some news, and that's the Myrtles. It's a big Myrtles plantation. So said to trap the spirits of Sarah Woodruff and her children. Many were poisoned in the plantation's tragic past. And yeah, there's one particular place in there that's got a gift. And it's pretty epic. So we got to do quick on the Myrtles plantation. So it was built at the end of the 18th century, and it gathered kind of stories the way it gathers dust. So basically, people talk about betrayals, sudden deaths, sorrow, folklore and history braided together there. It is hard to tell where one ends and one begins. I love the Myrtles. It's one of my favorite places. And there's one story that everybody knows.
Well, it's beautiful, but the word plantation tends to come with it.
Yes. Negative connotations. Exactly.
And not good parts of our history.
Exactly. But
it's a beautiful building.
Yeah. And it is history. That's the thing. It's history. Bad things happen in history. And, you know, you still have to explore them. Sadly, that's part of Erie Travels. We go to some bad places where bad stuff happened. So anyway, we're going to talk about Chloe. And Chloe was an enslaved woman who lived in the house. She was famous for wearing a green turban to hide some injury. And she moved through the rooms constantly. And basically the tale goes that she was punished, humiliated, and desperate. And she supposedly poisoned a cake meant for the family. Most stories say she was framed. And the result, according to legend, tragedy. Sarah Woodruff, two of her children die. Chloe was blamed and executed. Whether the records support this, it's not really certain. Now,
my guess, I hate to say it, is if she did do it, it might have been warranted.
Yeah, it could be justified.
Although you should never kill children and just, yeah.
Almost nothing justifies that. Almost.
Yeah.
But anyway, that what's the Southern custom, Erica, about mirrors?
You're supposed to put sheets over them when you're going to bed and stuff like that. You're not supposed to leave a mirror uncovered.
And also when there's a death.
Oh, yeah, that's true. So that your soul doesn't get trapped in there. Yeah.
Yep, exactly. So prevent a soul from getting caught in a glass. Well, the stories say the Woodruff mirror was not covered. So the house already filled with grief right there. The glass was exposed. And so the mirror absorbs what the house could not release. So suddenly faces start appearing in the silvering. And then handprints start showing up on it where no hand was touching. And visitors to this day say they still feel that chill while they're there. And the guides will tell you, do not stare too long at the mirror because you'll see what the house remembers. So tourists over the years have said they see fingerprints. Cameras sometimes capture smudges that aren't there when the photo was taken. Some swear they've seen a woman's sad face, others small shapes of children in the mirror. And of course, our friends, the skeptics, will just say it's condensation, imagination, pareidolia. Believers point to the same marks that return after cleaning. And what about these photos that, yeah, so it's a test, right? The mirror is that ultimate test. Where, what is it? And now the mirror has appeared many places other than the Myrtles. It was in a couple documentaries, and it was actually on a couple late night tours where they brought it to other places. And now this is in St. Francisville, Louisiana. It was built in 1796. And, you know, historical significance aside, it is an impressive structure and considered many one of the most haunted places in America. And it is a beautiful place to overlook the Mississippi River. I remember that. And beautiful oak trees, lots of Spanish moss, the classic. It's what Disney haunted
in that regard, but I am going to hard pass.
All right. Well, just remember, if you're ever there and looking at that mirror, just respect the history that came before. And just, you know that things have happened there that were terrible, but.
Agreed. Yeah. I mean, all it's right. Beautiful and, you know, just pay the proper respects while you're there.
Yep. So you ready to move on?
I was ready to not go on any of this journey.
Oh, well, so how about we do the classic Price is Right? And you open the next door and it's a new car. Da-da-da-da-da.
I don't think I'm getting a new car. What am I really getting?
Okay, it's an old car. We got to do the Wayback Machine to 1955.
Ooh.
All right. September 30th. So a little after my birthday. Do you remember James Dean?
Of course I remember James Dean. Rebel.
Yep, exactly. Now, he had an amazing car. It was a Porsche 550 Spyder. And this car was called the Little Bastard.
As it should be.
Yeah. The Little Bastard almost was a problem the minute Dean bought it. So Dean met British actor Alec Guinness, Obi-Wan himself, in Los Angeles. And Guinness saw this car and said immediately he had this ominous feeling about the Porsche. And Guinness actually wrote this in his diary. Here's the quote, and I'll try to do my best Obi-Wan Kenobi. The sports car looked sinister to me, exhausted, hungry. Feeling a little ill-tempered in spite of Dean's kindness, I heard myself saying in a voice I could hardly recognize as my own, please never get in it. If you get in that car, you will be found dead in it by this time next week.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah, that's in Alec Guinness's diary. So Dean, of course, laughs it off and sets about preparing the car for the Salinas sports car races, because James Dean was a freaking race car driver as well as an actor. And this is at the height of his career, right? And he had Porsche mechanic Wolf Wutherlich. Yeah, try to say that one twice. And of course, stuntman Bill Hickman was the guy they basically based Once Upon a Time in Hollywood on. And their plan was to tow the little bastard to the races. But the engineer said, why don't you get used to the spider and run it a little bit, run with the engine on. And that fateful Friday, September 30th, 1955, Dean and Wutherlich are in the car. Dean's driving, Wutherlich's riding, and Hickman's following them in his truck with the trailer. And the police pull them over because they're speeding right outside Bakersfield. And they're like, oh, so the trailer got a ticket, the car got a ticket. But the cop let him go because, hey, it's a ticket. It's a speeding ticket. And it's freaking James Dean. But it didn't slow Dean down at all. So he's barreling down Route 486, about 85 miles an hour. And a young student named Donald Turnipseed was driving a Ford Tudor. And he makes a sudden turn. And their impact sent that Ford about 40 feet down the road. It ejected Wutherlich from the Porsche. And Dean was pronounced dead on arrival at the hospital at 6:20 p.m. So, sad, right? The car, total loss by the insurance company. But that's not the end. Because parts of it, they pulled Ghost of Flight 401 here. We're going to salvage parts and we're going to use it. So, a doctor buys it, Dr. William Esrich. He buys the Porsche from a salvage yard in Burbank and stripped it for parts. He installed the engine into his Lotus 9 race car, and then he loaned the transmission and suspension parts to another doctor and racer, Troy McHenry. Now, Esrich crashes the Lotus at the 1956 Pomona sports car races. He survives, but McHenry wasn't as lucky. He hit a tree, was killed in the same race, and so this is where the curse begins. Right.
Wow.
So the Porsche itself carries on, because after the crash, one of our king of the customs guys, one of our favorite people from history, George Barris, he's the guy who made the Batmobile. He made the Munsters cars and all that. Ever the king for publicity, he snags it. He's like, I'm going to rebuild this thing because it's James Dean's car. I'm rebuilding this. And he's also capitalizing on the curse at this point. But he couldn't fix it. It's beyond recovery. So what does he do? He gives it to the Los Angeles chapter of National Safety Council. And from 1957 to 1959, they take it on tour to show people what speeding can do. They take it to schools and theaters and bowling alleys. While it's on tour, though, March of 1959, in storage in Fresno, the car catches fire.
A car without an engine catches fire.
In a storage shed.
Okay.
But it doesn't suffer much damage. Just two tires melt. And the paint's a little singed. But this was this huge fire. But it didn't spread to any other vehicles in storage or anything. Just on this car. It's like spontaneous combustion.
That's so weird.
Yep. And now the thing is, he sells the other two tires. Because Barris never gave up on any money. And then they went to this other car, this other Porsche, and that car gets the both tires blow out at the exact same time, and that driver almost dies in a car accident.
Wow.
Tons of other unconfirmed stories about little bastard's post-accident life. Supposedly, while it was on display in Sacramento, it fell off of its display stand and injured somebody. It supposedly killed a man at another accident stop. I was one of the guys who was driving it from expo to expo. And then it was in a train boxcar in 1960 from Miami to Los Angeles, and it disappeared and has never been seen since.
Wow.
And a lot of people say that was Barris again, ever the showman, that he, took it away and, oh, it's a curse. It would disappear.
Yeah, well, I mean, but he'd have it reappear later to make some more money.
He would. He would. So what do you think of the car?
I think I don't want to be anywhere near it. And if I had somebody that I trusted say, I've got a bad feeling, you got to listen when people say they got a bad feeling.
When Obi-Wan Kenobi tells you he has a bad feeling, you listen, right?
Yeah. Exactly. Exactly.
Oh, my gosh. So the fun thing about this is 2006, the little bastard's whereabouts, still unknown, Jay Leno and a couple other car buffs put together $1 million reward for if anybody can figure out any location of any part of it.
Nobody's found it.
Yet. Yep. Not since 2005.
So wow. Wow.
Crazy.
Okay. So I've now had 11 very mostly unpleasant experiences. So what, pray tell, is going to be number 12, Mark?
The 12th day of Christmas. We got to give you a ring.
Oh.
So there were a couple rings that I thought of, but you know, as a newlywed, still deserve a ring. So, and then there's just this, you know, I was going to go King Tutankhamun's stuff because, hey, that's good. You know, James Dean's car was good, but this is the Ring of Destiny. So
the Ring of Destiny.
And we're still in Hollywood.
Oh, so,
the great Rudolph Valentino, Rudy Valentino. He was one of the earliest and brightest icons on film. His presence, all the women loved him, right? Of the silent era. He was, he's the Hugh Jackman of his day. He's the George Clooney of his day. Times 10, man. Every woman loved him and men wanted to be him. The classic. Tragic death, 1926, age of 31. And, you know, fan suicides were reported when he passed. His New York City memorial caused riots as hundreds of thousands of people flooded the streets to see him. And, so all that, but we have to talk about his ring. And it had a tiger's eye stone. And again, he didn't listen. So 1922, he's in San Francisco.
Oh.
So are you dressing for this for the Wayback Machine?
Of course I'm dressing for this. Any excuse.
All right. So are you going flapper? What are you going?
I'm going 100% full flapper. If we're good, I have beaded dresses. I already have the dresses. I'm going to wear my red one. I'm excited.
All right. That works. That works. So, all right. So he sees the ring in the window of an antique shop, and he's just drawn to it. And the shopkeeper tells him, this ring's cursed. Don't buy it. It's not for you. I have it in the window because it's pretty, but I really don't want to sell it. But, you know, it's Rudolph Valentino. He's got money. And the guy's telling him, it's known as the Ring of Destiny, and everybody who's got it has misfortune. And he's like, I'm freaking Rudolph Valentino. I got it. So the minute
what misfortune could my brilliance have?
All right, exactly. So he first wears the ring during the filming of The Young Raja, and it becomes like his first bomb ever. And flopped, derided by critics. The audience hated it. And basically, it's his only stumble in his career, right? Yeah, maybe a couple others, but this is the first one that really hits him. And then suddenly, he's beset by legal issues. His health starts going bad. The public criticism's getting to him. And so he's like, you're right. Screw this ring. I'm putting it away. As soon as he did, boom, things come around. He recovers his health. His career recovers. But then a few years later, he gets cast in this movie called The Son of the Sheik. And that's, you know, his famous one. So he once again wears the ring as part of a costume. And shortly after the film's release, that's when he died during a promotional tour. He had perforated gastric ulcers, a very rare disease. And according to what doctors would now term Valentino's syndrome, you'd think that would be the end. But
I doubt it is. Continue.
So the ring passes to his girlfriend, Paula Nigri. She's an actress. and she's becomes his next victim. Basically, Negri's health declined immediately. Her career stopped. Her personal life spiraled into disarray. And so she stopped wearing the ring and passed it to her friend, Russ Colombo. Not, geez, I hate to bother you, but it's in that name. And he was known as the Valentino of radio because he had this romantic voice, and the promotional pictures made him look a lot like Rudy Valentino. And in 1934, height of his fame, he was wearing the ring, and he again dies in a strange, tragic accident when a friend was showing him an antique pistol and fatally shot him.
Wow.
Now, his girlfriend at the time is Carol Lombard, and he hands her, she gets the ring. And then that year, she dies in a plane crash.
My goodness.
Yeah. So the ring comes into possession of Joe Cassino, a friend of Colombo's. Cassino, fully aware of the ring's reputation, does not wear it. And his friends start mocking him about it. You're superstitious. You're silly. Do you get people doing that to you, Erica, when you nope out of things?
I do. And yeah. I still maintain my nopeness.
Yep. And you still do a podcast with
your
guy.
Peer pressure is not going to get me to go do something. Mark can trick me into things, but peer pressure is not going to get me into doing something. You All know right. that.
I know that. I know that. So guess what he does? He caves and puts on the ring. And a week later, he's killed in a car accident.
Oh, my goodness.
So it was passed to his brother, Del Cassino, and he wore it forever. Never had a problem. He even lent the ring to a Valentino impersonator. But then that person didn't have a problem. But then a thief named Joe Willis stole the ring from Del's house. And in the chase, Willis was shot and killed, and the ring was discovered in his possession. Now there are newspaper articles and sensationalizing the curse. But Jack Dunn is the next victim. He's an actor auditioning to play Valentino in a biopic, and he asked to borrow the ring for a screen test. And apparently his performance was off the chart, and he was going to get it. Suddenly he gets leukemia and dies a week later.
Suddenly gets leukemia? Leukemia.
Never had it before. Never had any signs of it.
Wow.
Leukemia, dead in a week. A week.
That's insane.
So Del Cassino locks the ring in the Los Angeles bank's vault. The bank was robbed. The ring was stolen. Recovered. But the building also suffered severe damage in a fire. So the ring has current whereabouts unknown. But we don't know where it's at now. It could be out there. So
I am going to avoid tiger's eye rings that look like that. I see what a picture of it looks like. I'm going to hard pass just in case.
All right. I have one other ring I'm going to mention as an honorable mention. This is your stocking stuffer.
Okay.
This one is called the Ring of Sylvanus or the Ring of Cenarius. And the Ring of Sylvanus, or is also called the Vine Ring, it was a gold ring from 1600 years ago. And basically, the owner begged the gods to curse anyone who possesses it. Okay. And it is on display in the Vine Manor. And this is the ring that was the inspiration for a certain ring. So basically the story is sometime during the 4th century, a guy named Sylvanus, a Roman stationed in Gloucestershire, England, he visited the elaborate baths of the Celtic god Nodens. And these are basically on a hill, and it's just this beautiful. Nodens is this Roman British deity, basically healing and the sea. I think he's also the god of hunting and dogs for some reason. But anyway, he's a fairy king, right? He's he kind of becomes Nuada Agrateam, the Tuatha De Danann king. But basically, he was disqualified from ruling Ireland because he lost his hand in a battle. So anyway, he's basically the Fisher King of Arthur legends, we think. But anyway, Sylvanus is at the temple, and his ring was stolen. And he believed it was a guy named Senatius who stole the ring. Now, how he knows this, who knows? But all we know is he goes to the temple and prepares a lead plate We call those defixios, or the curse tablets. And he inscribes on it in Latin. I'm not going to give you guys the Latin because we're short for time. It just basically says in Latin, for the god Nodens, Sylvanus has lost a ring and has donated one half of its worth to Nodens. Among those named Synatius, permit no good health until it is returned to the temple of Nodens.
Okay.
So now, we don't know, you know, we just got that, right? So where's this ring? Well, we know Sylvanus would have owned this ring at one point because it was like, and it was, it would have had like 10 gold sides, probably meant to be on a thumb or outside a glove because it's pretty big. But it was found perhaps by a later Christian owner because there's a Latin inscription on it that's Senecae vivus in Dei.
Which means?
Which it's probably misspelled because it should be Senecae viva in Deo. But he put in an extra I, so there was no room for the E.
Too many vowels.
Too many vowels, which would have meant Synatius, may you live with God. So Synatius, realizing he was cursed, put this anti-curse on the ring, right? So
that is hysterical.
So the ring was discovered in 1785 in a field, again, with another Roman origin town of Silchester. And then some researchers say the ring was lost. Some people say, oh, this dude just got rid of that ring. Right? He threw it away.
I would have done that. Yes.
Anyway, the farmer who found it, he sold the ring to another guy who was a historian. And it's not till 1888, 100 years later, that somebody notices the ring and he writes a paper on it because it's just such an interesting story, the paper. And it's not till 1929 that somebody realizes this ring matches that curse tablet. So then they can't really confirm 100%, but Synatius is not exactly a common name. It's not like John Smith or something like that. Yeah. So he goes to this professor at Oxford University to ask them about Nodens. Who the hell is this god, right? I don't know anything about it. And this professor is this guy named J.R.R. Tolkien. And
the One Ring?
Does that not sound like this is the inspiration?
Yes.
For the One Ring? This guy loses his ring. Somebody loses his ring. He's convinced somebody's stolen it, so he curses him. And then, you know, curse Baggins! Thief! Thief Baggins! Yeah.
So, wow. That's very cool, though.
Yeah, right?
I don't know about either one of those rings as my stocking stuffer, but I will take a replica.
All right. Well, you can go to the Vine Manor and see the ring anytime you want. And yeah, it's dating back to 4th century, discovered in the 1780s. And it's a Tolkien bonus, right?
No, it's a Tolkien bonus. I love that. Shout out to my Tolkien friend, Jen, who would appreciate that thoroughly.
I thought she might.
Not the first ring part, but the other parts. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, anyway, I know people were expecting a couple other items on this list, but
we're not going to mention those.
I'm not going to mention them, except that one is not a present. He is the best boy, and he can't be given to anybody. Nope. He lives in Key West. You can go visit him, but we're not, you know, Merry Christmas, Robert. We love you.
Merry Christmas, Robert. And I want to do a little shout out at the end to somebody whose work has inspired a lot of joy in my life, and I know a lot of yours, just because I didn't want to consider it breaking news, but we unfortunately lost Rob Reiner the week we're recording this. Yep. There's a lot around that. I'm sure there's a lot of stuff that's going to come, but we might have to list some of our favorite Rob Reiner movies ever. But I will say A Few Good Men is one of my favorite movies. I can handle it all the time. And When Harry Met Sally.
Yeah, I'll have what she's having. Think about all the lines from his movies that we use. We'll crank it to 11, As You Wish, Inconceivable.
Oh, I mean, gosh, Princess Bride.
Do you want to see a dead body? Stand by me. Come on. You know, the one from that one that always gets me is, holy shit, what is Goofy? Mickey's a mouse.
It's so true. But yeah, so just a little love out in the universe. And yeah. I think there's a couple other people you lost recently.
Oh man, this is a rough week. We lost Gil Gerard, Buck Rogers, my childhood hero. Oh my gosh, he was the man we all wanted to be, and hanging out with space babes and making quirky one-liners to every stranger he meets. My God, that's me. I didn't realize it until I thought about it. So I was like, oh my gosh, he really was me. You know, he struggled with his weight his whole life. That's very familiar. And he was real, man. He was a real deal. And then we lost Bob Burns of Bob's Basement. This was the guy who collected everything. The reason we still have half the props that we would have lost. The studios were just throwing stuff away, and he would rescue it. And that, so he was the ultimate film historian. Going through his house one day, I just met Forrest Ackerman that day, so who was the king of horror. And then here I am in Bob's basement with both of them learning about science fiction and fantasy props. And every turn, it was just like, oh my God, is that? And he'd be like, oh yeah, 100%. And then he'd give me a 20-minute diatribe on how he wound up with the War of the Worlds ship, you know, and where he wound up with his good friend Ray Harryhausen's skeleton from Sinbad. Oh my God, it was incredible. And to lose both of them on the same day, that was freaking brutal. So
yeah. So even though we're going into the holiday season, and you know, mm-hmm. you're going to get this episode before last one, which I think for the next week, we're going to do a listener tales episode for you guys. But I will say that sending positive vibes out in the world for those that made an impact on our lives that we have lost. And Mark, take us away, because I am not interested in keeping a single one of my 12 days of Christmas.
All right. Well, I'll just drink some eggnog and wash it down with those Nuka-Colas I got you. Listeners, travelers, thank you so much. Thanks for everything. We hope you've enjoyed this year. We hope you've enjoyed our 12 days of cursed Christmas.
Tell us what your favorite cursed items are.
Yeah, yep, exactly. Let us know. I've made Erica unwrap a dozen gifts that she didn't ask for, from diamonds to dolls and paintings and statues and mirrors and a car. Everything is tragedy. And sometimes the worst gift isn't socks and a tie, right? Sometimes it's something that stares back at you. The past isn't gone. It's waiting in the glass. So sleep tight, and may your holidays be haunted only by cheer. And we'll see you on the other side.
This isn't just a game, it's a once-in-a-generation event. The Harlem Globetrotters 100-year tour. Celebrate 100 years of high-flying dunks, 100 years of show-stopping moves, and 100 years of changing the game. Bring the whole family and be part of the legacy. This game is once in a century. Be there at Schottenstein Center on December 27th. Go to harlemglobetrotters.com for your tickets to the 100-year tour.